Judiciary committee order at 112. For the record, please, Madam Secretary.
Representative Green?
Here.
Representative Roper?
Here.
Representative James?
Here.
Representative Murkowski?
Here.
Representative Croft? Representative Cortula?
Here.
Chairman Cott?
Here. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and where we left off the last time we were in committee was with House Bill 57. I believe we closed public testimony off. Is there anyone here in the audience?
Take me to your leader.
Jeanette wants
to. I'm sure that's what they said.
She caused me to grow hair.
Jeanette wants to be taken to the leader. Beam her up, Scotty. Is there anyone here in the audience that wishes to and haven't at this time testified on House Bill 57? So hearing none, then we are in the, we'll close public testimony. I believe we do have with Gail online. Gail, are you there? Beam her up. Beam her down.
Beamer.
Pretty heavy duty, yeah. Where's Representative Croft?
We can move this real quick.
That's right. Hey, we were here and you weren't.
We have a whole bunch of amendments.
Yeah, you're excellent. Hello, the first one's pretty good.
Beth will introduce him. Gail, are you there? Gail?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we have closed, this is Representative Cott, we have closed public testimony and we're going to dispense with a number of amendments, and you're more than willing to make comments on them as we proceed. I think that would be beneficial to the committee. Did Mike get in yet? Corey, has Mike come online? Nope. Mike, are you online? No. Okay, we do have a series of amendments that are planning to be offered. And we have amendment number 2, which is being offered by Representative Roper. So please identify the amendment by Representative Roper as amendment number 2, page 3, lines 11 to 16.
Do we have that?
I don't.
It just passed out.
Oh.
No.
Is that yours?
No, I have mine. Okay. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, let me just delete it before we ask. No, I move amendment number 2, Mr. Chairman.
Object for point of discussion.
There's an objection.
Mr. Chairman, I also would like to move an amendment to my amendment. The first page 3 paragraph, deleting lines 11 through 16, I'd like to delete that section.
Delete the delete.
Okay. The first language that was deleted is reinserted.
Yeah, delete the entire first paragraph.
Oh, the whole first paragraph. Okay.
Yeah. I'm deciding not to offer that this time. Is there any?
That brings us back to
amendment number
amendment
two,
as amendment as amended, which deletes lines 20 to 23 on page 3, and right. Inserts additional language. There's an objection. Can you,
Mr. Chairman,
explain the amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, the nature of this amendment is merely to clarify the definition of what a year 2000 date change is. In the bill before us, it has language of between the 20th and 21st century. There is seems to be some confusion or so forth with the public about what day that is. Is that the January 1st, 2000, or is it January 1st, 2001? So in order to clarify this, because the issue truly is one of integers, not concepts, I offer the amendment to the committee as a mere clarification of what the definition of
Mr. Chairman,
year 2018 is.
Representative Croft.
Is that then amendment number two, because we passed amendment number one?
Yes, it is amendment number two.
And we've deleted the first part, and it's just now the one on the year 2000 date change.
That's correct.
Great.
Everybody understand the amendment? Is there still an objection?
No, I think you really feel that there's a problem. People don't know we're in the 20th century.
There is confusion. There absolutely is. I mean, the issue is it's the year, the date 2001, and the other particular dates that are part of the Y2K problem. There's, Mr. Chairman, there's an 18-month period generally. It's the conventional wisdom, starting circa July 1st of this year, extending through the entire next year, that these type of millennium bug problems will arise. So it actually encompasses a rather long period of time. So the fiscal years, various other things, code problems like the September 9th, 1999 problem, and so forth. So there's a long period. But the point fact is here, it's just a point of clarification. It's January 1st, 2000, not 2001.
And we're not using the Chinese New Year as a start date.
The Chinese New Year provision that requested by the chairman has been deleted from this amendment.
Representative Green.
Well, I'm just... Did you include the process date or time data from, comma, in between comma?
Just deletes between the 20th and 21st centuries for between the calendar year 1999 and calendar year 2000. That's all it does.
Yeah. Further comments on the amendment? Just for technical clarification, the insertion parentheses 3 is really 4 based on the previous amendment that we adopted. Seeing no further objection, then amendment number 2 is adopted. Gail, after the fact, I would assume that you had no problem with this particular amendment.
I do apologize, Mr. Chair. I don't seem to have that amendment before me. I've been trying to pencil it in from the conversation I've been hearing, but I clearly comment since I don't have that amendment in front of me.
Do you have the...
I think it's just a clarification so that people understand the actual crime dates we're talking about rather than the 20th and 21st
century references, am I correct? That's correct. I don't have any comment as to a legal issue that would raise, again, with the caveat that I don't have the text in front of me of that amendment. Understand. We will now turn to amendment number 3, which is being introduced by Representative Croft, and it is the A.1 on the right top.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't offered any amendment yet. I'd like to offer A2 as amendment number 3, if I can.
Now, is this A2.
Does that mean A1 is...
20th century or the 21st?
You're removing A1, withdrawing it, or...
If I could take them out of order, I think it makes more sense. A2 first.
Okay. Did you then indicate what order you would like to take all four of those up in? I assume you still have the four amendments.
Yeah, I'd like to do A2, A1, A4, and I'm not going to be offering A3. So the
so
one...
A2, A4?
A2 and then A1.
A2, A1.
And
then A4?
No, I said he wasn't going to not.
Yeah, but... Part of the reason for that, Mr. Chairman, and part I apologize for the confusion, is...
Well, there seems to be a lot of confusion here. Would you again state the order of preference in which amendment you will not be offering?
If we could start...
A2 will be our new amendment number 3.
If A2 passes, there's no need for A1, is part of the the difficulty. So if we could go in order, I don't know what's going to happen with these, and so I don't know whether A1 will be offered or not.
Understand. Okay, everybody understand? We're all reading from the same sheet of music. A.2, Board 2899, is Amendment Number 3.
And I would move Amendment Number 3.
Object for purposes.
And there is
discussion.
An objection for purposes of discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Croft.
Thank you. As I said, there are two different amendments that discuss the standard of proof to get into this immunity. And so not knowing whether the first one was going to pass, it's difficult to know whether I'm going to offer the second. This simply sets some minimal standard of due diligence before you qualify for the immunity. In particular, it asks that you've made good faith efforts to avoid the failure. When I originally asked Mr. Poe about this, whether, because I had read before Representative Roekberg's business immunity bill, and there is a section in there that says you can't just get this if you've done nothing. You have to have made some sort of efforts, however we describe them, to respond to the Y2K, the potential of Y2K harm. I was told that there was a standard in there. Later said that he'd been mistaken and that it was not in. And right now we have a bill that says whether you have done zero, a little, a lot, you are treated exactly the same. My worry is, particularly with Amendment Number 1, which spreads this immunity to all sorts of subdivisions, different municipalities, we are treating exactly the same municipality X who has done zero, possibly in the face of notifications of potential harm, and municipality Y that has done substantial efforts. It just doesn't comport with individual or organizational responsibility to treat them the same. In general, people and organizations ought to be responsible for their actions or inactions. And so on a principled level, I have a worry with an immunity unqualified by conduct at all. But on a more practical note, Mr. Poe also told us when we met last that the way that the state has been able to meet this problem so far is by using the risk management fund in the state. There's other sources that are probably better that have met some difficulties, but that was the stopgap. And the justification for that was it's appropriate for us to use it because of the potential harm if we don't, the potential lawsuits if we don't. I would submit that if this blanket unqualified immunity were enacted a year ago, we could not have used that fund because there would be no risk to manage. We would not, even with the best of intentions, you will not get the same level of effort with no carrot or stick that you would with some partial one. It is what encourages people to function responsibly is some risk that they will be called to task if they don't. And to pass a bill that says states, municipalities, all sorts of local and state government units have no more responsibility to act responsibly, I feel practically will lead to the wrong result and is just a horrible public policy message.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the objector, I certainly concur with the logic that, I guess we don't have to be that formal, that Representative Croft indicated, but I'm concerned with the word preponderance of evidence, or the words. What I'm concerned there is that if the municipality is doing good faith, but it's not able to show to whoever the decision maker happens to be, a judge or a jury, that they, or it did in fact, with the huge preponderance of evidence overwhelmingly show that they did use good effort, I'm concerned we just open ourselves up to litigation. And what I would suggest, if the maker of the amendment would be so inclined, is on line 7, that we replace the words "by a preponderance of the evidence that the municipality," and just put in "that it." So it would read "no, would not apply unless the municipality showed that it used good faith efforts to avoid."
That would be...
It's in the second paragraph?
It's in the seventh line.
But it's, you don't have any problem with it in the third line?
Oh, I'm sorry, I just happened to see it in the ad, add-on. Yeah, I would say in both places that, that we should show that we have made good faith efforts. And I'm sure that a tribunal can figure whether there were good faith efforts, but I'm just worried about the word preponderance.
So if I can repeat the amendment, it's deleting by a preponderance of the evidence that the, mm-hmm. and simply putting that it shows mm-hmm. that it, well, no. then it's it municipal.
No, no, it goes through municipality.
That shows that.
That it.
Yeah.
Shows that the municipality has received the delete that.
He's doing a slightly different. That
well, the. I was doing it slightly different. I don't object. I was going to go through municipality and then it's just that it used. But if you want to stop short and use the municipality again, that's okay too.
Doesn't matter to me. Which would you
and
like
I
to
And I would
make?
Do this. And so I think Representative James makes a good point in line three that we modify that as well.
I have no objection to that amendment to the amendment.
Okay, there's a motion to amend the amendment. Is there objection from anyone? Seeing none, then the new amendment, as amended, is before us.
And I just, Mr. Now, Chairman,
can we read it?
We strike a line that we just strike shows by proponents of the evidence. We just strike that out.
That's correct. Is that the municipality shows that it used good faith efforts?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Michael Gaddy. I finally got online to testify.
Okay, Michael, I'll give you a chance to comment here as soon as we're through with the debate here on the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
My concern with this amendment still is that it seems like we are shifting the burden of proof to the defendant government body by creating this preponderance standard that must be met before this immunity defense to the lawsuit is invoked. And wouldn't that then suggest that there would be a number of filings for various reasons, and that in essence the state municipalities would tend to settle out of court, which would be an expensive ordeal for them? Representative Murkowski.
I'm looking at a copy of the federal legislation. This is United States Senate Bill 96, which is the Y2K fix at the federal level. And also attached to this package are copies of legislation that other states are dealing with right now with regards to the Y2K issue. And I've just done a real quick cursory look at things, but so far everything that I'm seeing shows that there is, at a minimum, some good faith effort, some due diligence that is required in order for the immunity to be invoked. And the federal legislation basically, I mean, it's very broad. It just says an exercise of due diligence and reasonable care to prevent it. So the standard is not something that I think is going to be difficult to achieve. I too am concerned that we don't have, that right now there's just an absolute blanket immunity without a requirement to show some good faith. Now, I don't remember whose newsletter I was reading yesterday. It was from the Alaska Municipal League. They have a publication that's basically stating to these municipalities, make sure you've done X, Y, and Z, 1, 2, and 3. As I understand, if a municipality, a utility, I don't care whether we're talking about state or private at this point in time, but if you can establish that you have done reasonable efforts to deal with the Y2K problem, I think that you're probably going to be okay, and you're not going to be having the litigation that we're so fearful of, or having these, basically, the large out-of-court settlements. But I think that we've got an obligation to say you've at least got you've got to demonstrate some amount of good faith.
Representative Curtula.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I concur in the comments made by Representative Murkowski, and I have a question, and either to Representative Croft or maybe to Ms. Voigtlander, who's on the phone. I just want to be clear then what we're leaving the standard being. If we take out the preponderance, and are we just going to a simple showing of, you know, just coming forward with an affidavit? What's our level really going to be? And I don't know.
Gail, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did, Chairman. Well, I think if you strike the language shows by a preponderance of the evidence, the court is still, in interpreting the statute, going to know what the standard is for it to arrive at that decision. And so I think it may end up being that it's going to impose a preponderance of the evidence standard. In any event, so that there still was, the court has to graft on some standard. If the statute doesn't give the standard, then the court is going to have to graft on what it believes to be what the standard should be. If I may comment further, just generally about it, as a practical matter, if you're having the state or the municipality have to make a showing of good faith effort, I would anticipate, and I'm a courtroom type person, I would anticipate that you would end up having to go to trial because of the reason that the courts cannot grant summary judgment if there are any genuine issues of material fact. And the courts may say that in deciding whether or not a municipality or the state had used good faith efforts, that is an issue of fact that has to be decided by the trier of fact, which would be the jury, if that's what the parties requested, or the court if there was not a request for a jury trial. As a practical matter, then, if you have to go to trial, you really are not having any immunity, because immunity is intended to cut off the claim so that the governmental entity, be it the state or the municipality, does not have to incur defense costs to have such claims dismissed. If you look at the parallel, the state sovereign immunity provisions in AS 950-250, there are a number of areas where it is immune. As a practical matter, if someone sues the state on one of those theories that the legislature has said that the state is immune for, then the state can file a motion to dismiss right at the get-go to have the claim dismissed, and if worst case scenario, perhaps have to go to summary judgment, but be able to demonstrate that immunity up front and therefore not have to incur the cost of proceeding throughout lengthy litigation and a trial. The only other comment I would make on the comments thus far is S-96 that was referred to by Representative James. That bill is not intended to be directed towards governmental entities. It's a standard that is put out there for the general business community. I mean, that bill, if enacted, relates to all businesses. It's not a bill that relates to a sovereign immunity of either the state or local government.
Representative James.
Well, I think she just answered the question that I had. Was it seemed to me like that putting this in here, you haven't avoided a lawsuit, and that the intent was here to avoid a lawsuit. This doesn't do it.
Representative Croft.
Concerning your point, Mr. Chairman, I mean, I think it's a good one. It took me a little bit of time tracking down. We can switch that around. And my concern is that there is no standard of care at all. There's no, you're not asking people to act to any particular amount of care. It is nice to have an immunity. It means you don't have to do any efforts. It means you don't have to worry about ever getting called to task for what you did. It'd be nice if this committee could immunize me for everything I ever did, because I wouldn't have to worry so much about being sued. The worry, though, is what makes our innate goodness, but also our worry that we will get called to task for what we do wrong, is what makes us perform correctly. And it's very worrisome to give anyone a blank check to act as however they want. But I think it's even more worrisome to give the state and municipalities, the government, the right to do whatever it wants. Just on your point, Mr. Chairman, if we said the immunity described in this subsection applies only if the affected party shows that the state or municipality did not use good efforts to avoid the failure, we've put that burden back on the party suing to show you didn't. And I think we could do that in both places just by flipping it around.
It places the burden of proof back on the, takes it off the defendant, which would be the state. Puts it back on the other party.
Through the chair.
Representative Curtula.
Thank you. That shifts the burden back, and we'd still have the same standard. So I think that that's a much more reasonable way to do it if you want to allow immunity. And at the same time, make it so that there has to be some showing that there was some due diligence.
Representative James.
Well, yeah, and I agree with putting the responsibility of showing the evidence by the person who's doing the suing. But, you know, what I'm trying to think about we're doing here is the Y2K problem, which is a universal problem that no one asked for and no one prepared to get into this position. And I think that is different than if you have some other situation that is part of your ongoing business that you should have been smart enough to do something about. And the reason I say that is because it is so expansive that no matter what good faith efforts you may use, you still may not get there, and someone may be harmed. And so it seems to me like that in the beginning that there is some good reason to give immunity on this issue, because the issue is so unpredictable and not necessarily of our own making.
Well, clearly is true. Certainly, there's a bunch of computer geeks in the 60s that got us into this mess. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, while I'm sympathetic to the fact that we need to make sure that municipalities and the state exercise some degree, the fact that the court sounds like it's going to shift into a mode that we don't want, where we're talking about you have to defend yourself with a preponderance of evidence, I think perhaps we have misnumbered these, and I would think that maybe Representative Croft's number 4 would be a little bit better attitude, where it says, in that regard, we have an immunity unless there is gross negligence, if we can ever define that term, which says that you actually really screwed up, and therefore there should be some liability. As opposed to, if I can't defend, I'm working my fanny off trying to do something, but I can't show 51%, I'm dead meat. To me, that's too severe. Because I think everybody is made aware now that there is at least potentially a Y2K problem, and we have just allocated a lot of funds to try and correct that. Would the court say that whatever ended up being $14 million is an effort to avoid the, or is that a preponderance of evidence, or is that just so be it? We got a $23 billion trust fund, so this really isn't preponderance of evidence.
Thank you, Representative Green. For those that are on the teleconference line, if you would hold your paper shuffling down to a minimum, our committee secretary is saying it's having some effect on distorting the comments made by the committee members as it's being taped. Thank you. Representative Tula.
Oh, it was a comment, thank you, Mr. Chairman, going back to Representative James's comment. I think that the intention behind the amendment is so that someone can, the court, can hear what the situation was before going ahead with the immunity. So there would be a finding. There'd be a finding of fact. You'd have to have some kind of a showing so that the person could come forward and say, here are the circumstances. And it, you know, it's only going to be under circumstances where a municipality truly has sat around and not done anything, where then the court, you know, goes forward. So it's not, it has to take into consideration the circumstances. This is the point. Thanks.
Gail, you've heard the comments by the committee members on this particular amendment. Do you have any further comments? And if not, I'll turn to Mike.
Yes, to the chair. The practical reality is that unless the bill says otherwise, the court can't make findings of fact if they're disputed. I mean, the methodology is that the party would move for summary judgment, and if the other side said that there were material issues of genuine fact, the court would have to say, well, then I can't rule because it's not a matter of law, it's a matter of fact, and that has to go to the fact finder. You then have a battle of the experts in terms of what is due diligence, you know, what does that standard mean? It's kind of, I don't see it very much different than arguing in a negligence case whether or not someone's efforts were reasonable, and those go to trial. So as a practical matter, the way it's worded, if you intersect that with the rules of civil procedure, you are still looking at, as long as there are genuine issues of material fact, going to a trial, which the more sophisticated the issues, and I presume that if one has to litigate Y2K issues, it's going to be very sophisticated types of technology discussions. It's going to be involved fairly complex litigation.
Thank you, Gail. Mike?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Gaddy. I'm the Mattoon Borough Attorney. I'm also on the attorney member for the Board of Directors for the Alaska Municipal League. And Julie Graft asked me to listen in and maybe make a couple of comments on the Y2K bill, HB 57, currently before you. And generally speaking, the Municipal League supports the bill. However, the amendments that are proposed are somewhat problematic and we believe improvident. And the reason that we do is that, first of all, some of the discussion with regarding extent of the immunity, if there's a good faith showing required by the municipality, actually guts the immunity. You're still, as Ms. Voigtlander said, she's very well experienced in trial matters. You're probably not going to survive a summary judgment motion, so in most cases you'll go to trial. And the Alaska Supreme Court has said that in negligence cases, usually they are fact intensive, and that being the case, it's unlikely that we will grant summary judgment. So there's a preference on the part of the Supreme Court not to grant summary judgment. So if you get a fact issue that a party can litigate, it could, some of the committee members have expressed this concern, extract settlements from municipalities or cause municipalities to go to trial. And if any of you have been involved in litigation in the near term through your official capacities or otherwise, you know how terribly expensive that can be. It impacts the public entity that's being litigated and the officials that typically should be doing their jobs to serve the public are distracted by engaging in litigation. But it's a tremendous cost to the government. The other thing is, it's not unusual for the legislature to grant blanket immunity for certain governmental activities. And if you look at the state immunity statute, there's a laundry list of immunities. There's immunities in common law, there's immunities on the federal side, and 0965070 contains a number of immunities And in cases that say, one of them is JNL Diversified versus Tony Knowles and Chip Dennerline involving a platting matter where they were charged with abuse of process, the court said that it was a bad faith claim. We don't care if there's bad faith. There's certain activities that the government should be immune from, and this is one of them. So no case, plaintiffs. And we think that that's a good idea because the public officials engaging in this activity are presumed to be acting validly. That's what the law says. And as such, they should be afforded protection to make their decisions without fear of litigation, so they do make good decisions. And the burden typically to show that a public official did not act validly is on the person charging the wrongdoing. So this language, the good faith language and the preponderance language, shifts that burden to the municipality. Furthermore, is it an affirmative defense or is it a burden-shifting technique? That's a legal issue that I haven't really thought through quite yet. Also, Representative Croft said that he would love to have blanket immunity. Well, he does. He has legislative immunity, and I can cite the cases for you. One of them is Dankworth. In that case, Mr. Dankworth was charged with two counts of criminal conflict of interest. And the court said, sorry, since he engaged in legislative activity during this time where he was attempting to obtain a procurement for a pipeline camp that he owned, there's no case against him. Another case, the title of it is Cortula versus Abood.
I knew that was coming.
Senator Cortula had been subpoenaed to testify in a dispute, a legislative dispute, and the court said, sorry, you can't subpoena legislators for activities where they're engaged in legislative conduct because it disrupts the process, it distracts them from the case at hand, and they're here to do the job for the people. So we give them blanket immunity for activities within the legislative sphere, and indeed the Supreme Court has said the same thing and has given local officials legislative immunities in the case of the Bogan-Harris case, which came down in 98. So legislators do have blanket immunity for legislative acts and can't even be subpoenaed to testify on matters that they might have information on if the activity is within the legislative context. The other thing is, while the Massu Borough has been, in my opinion, diligently engaged in Y2K compliance issues, other communities that perhaps don't have the resources, although we always need extra resources for roads and schools and so on, but other Bush communities that may not have the professional staff or information about these issues could be unduly penalized by this. And we all know that some of the Bush communities do have a difficult time providing public services. It's expensive, and if they have to suffer litigation because of Y2K issues, it could really devastate a Bush treasury. So there's some of those impacts that I think are important for the committee to consider. I think again that Ms. Voigtlander was correct about the summary judgment issue, and this could potentially open the floodgates of litigation. And if you go to websites, you see some of the big law firms in the lower 48 are gearing up with Y2K litigation sections. And this is going to be a big issue for litigation in the turn of the century. And if municipalities, because they've made some oversight, are subject to it, they could be spending a lot of time and money defending against these issues. Finally, when you look at 0965070, there's a section that talks about immunities for enhanced 911 services, and that gives them immunity unless there's an intentional act of misconduct or an act of gross negligence. Obviously, 911 systems have embedded chips and would be Y2K problematic. So would there be a conflict between the immunity that the legislature would pass by having a preponderance of evidence and good faith standard applied to the municipality's conduct and the immunity that's been provided to a 911 system? I don't know the answer to that, but I just lay that on the table because it's just one of the issues that lawyers love to look at. And trust me, somebody will, and somebody will raise that issue. And typically when you have a lawsuit, you go through your laundry list of defenses, and in most cases use various discretionary immunities and any specific immunities that you might have. And it's really quite helpful to municipalities because it saves them a lot of time, effort, and anguish. If you've ever represented a municipal official who's been sued personally or even because of something we have done, it's very emotionally wrenching for those particular individuals. And I've represented municipalities for over 15 years. I've represented a lot of municipal officials, and I know how they feel when somebody files a complaint against them. And I'll sum up. I know that I'm sort of raising a number of issues here, but I guess just in summary, I'd like to say that municipalities, in my experience, at least my clients, act in good faith. Their conduct is to do the best job they can for the public, and when they need the help of the legislature for this problem that was not caused by them, so that they're not suffering under lawsuits that they have to come in and defend and take their time away from the important public business that they need to attend to. Thank you very much, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Mike, for refreshing our memory on historical perspective of legislative immunity. I thought politicians and school teachers were bad, but I think you're equally up to the task. I like your remarks. This is my last point, and finally, and in summary, you got your money's worth. Representative Catula.
Thank you, and it's good to hear Mr. Gaddy. We took the bar together, so I think quite highly of his acumen. But if I could, through the chair, just ask if you heard Representative Croft's revision to his amendment, which would have shifted the burden back to the affected party to show that the state or municipality didn't use good faith efforts to avoid the failure that caused the damages claimed. I just wondered if you heard that, Michael.
Yes, Representative Grutula, I did, and I have to reassert that we would respectfully urge the committee not to adopt those amendments and allow for the immunity as originally proposed without the amendments, because we think that's important to protect the municipalities and the state as well, because these things will cost money, and the state agencies will be coming to you and asking for more money to defend these cases.
Through the chair.
Yeah,
I can understand that concern, but wouldn't you agree that simply showing, you know, that there was, I mean, that a good faith effort isn't a very high standard of requiring municipalities to live up to?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Grutula, I agree with you. I think that municipalities typically do engage in good faith conduct, but as Ms. Voigtlander said, the burden is shifted over to the plaintiff to show bad faith, which would typically be how it is anyway, or left with the municipality to show good faith. The question is, are you going to pass muster on a summary judgment issue? And the likelihood of that is probably remote. So with the standard either cutting in favor of the municipality or in favor of the plaintiff, I think you get to the same place, a trial.
Hey, anyway, Mike. Representative Croft, did you have a comment?
Well, I'd like to wrap up, and so we can move on. We've got other issues to tend to. I guess I would move to amend my amendment to say the immunity described in this subsection, I passed it out in handwritten form. I have pretty bad handwriting, but the immunity described in this subsection applies only if the affected party shows that the state did not use good faith efforts to avoid the failure that caused the damages claimed in the civil action. And then the same sentence substituting for state municipality in the other section. So it would be state on page 3, lines 9, following others, and page 4, line 23, inserting municipality.
And I believe that would be, I have to get a ruling. I believe that would be out of order because we have an amendment that has been amended, and now we're amending that amendment. So I would have to rule that one out of order.
Then I'll withdraw amendment number 3 and submit that text as amendment number 4, if that'd be the easiest way to do it for you.
That would be the easiest way, okay. So everybody understands amendment number three has been withdrawn.
And move what I passed out.
Amendment number four is on the bottom, handwritten, of amendment number three.
Just to repeat what it is, amendment number four takes that text and puts it in page three, line nine, following others, with the word state in where the brackets are. And then on page four, line 23, following municipality, puts that same text except with municipality in instead of state where the brackets are.
You want to move that?
I'll move amendment number four as described.
Amendment number four, as described, has been moved. Is there objection?
Object.
Object.
There's objection. Do you want to speak to your objection, or do we want to speak to the amendment? Representative Green.
I want to speak to the amendment, and I'm not purposely trying to torpedo your amendments, but could we, after the third line of your handwritten portion after shows, could we put in by clear and convincing evidence? And this obviously increases the bar for somebody, the hurdle, whatever, for somebody bringing litigation. But I think they should be, it should be something that is going to be tough for them before they, not that this would ever happen, before they bring any kind of a nuisance suit in the attempt to not go to trial and settle out of court. This point for litigants to trifle with either a municipality or the state, and so often if they're of a minor nature, for example, we have these small claims courts up to $7,000, well, there could be a rash of those that are of that type that, well, we don't want to go to court, it'll cost us more to defend ourselves than that, so we'll just settle out of court. But if they know they're going to have to show by clear and convincing evidence, and you say, okay, we'll go to court, maybe that would deter them a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, that is...
Representative Green, I appreciate that comment, and I just got to remind this committee that 80 out of the 200 critical functions of government are currently in compliance with Y2K. So that means 120 functions that any litigant can then tackle to get into the courts. I appreciate you raising the threshold up, though, that at least satisfies a little bit of my concern. Representative James?
Well, my objection to the amendment is basically what I said before, and in the Y2K problem, it appears to me that there's nothing wrong with giving immunity, and that would be my choice to do, because anything else you do, you're not going to avoid lawsuits, and you're not going to avoid costs, and I just prefer to leave it as an immunity item.
Representative Croft and then Murkowski.
I just say that, yeah, it does change the standard a fair amount. It does put a significant burden to this. It wouldn't be my first choice, but if it would help to put some standard of care into this bill so that we're not absolving in a blanket way people who've done nothing in this regard, if it helped to do that, I'd do that. So I would accept that as a friendly amendment to add by clear and convincing evidence.
Okay, there was a friendly amendment that at least has been taken friendly, like. Is there objection? Seeing none, then we have amendment number four before us as amended. Representative Murkowski.
Could we hear comments from either Ms. Voigtlander or Mr. Gaddy regarding this amendment to the amendment?
We can, and Gail, if you could keep your comments as brief as possible, you are on the timer. Thank you.
Thank you, through the chair, to the representative. I'm sorry, I forgot who had asked the question.
That was Representative Murkowski.
Thank you, Representative Murkowski. It is a higher standard of proof under the civil standards of proof. Preponderance of the evidence is characterized as 51% versus 49%. Clear and convincing evidence is a much higher standard. It is the standard that is imposed for a finding of punitive damages against individuals. And so it is a much higher form under the rules of civil procedure and under substantive civil law. So it does make it a higher threshold that has to be established.
I appreciate that, but does it make this amendment any more acceptable to you, I guess, is my question.
Through the chair, Representative Murkowski, I think in terms of acceptability, that's more of a policy issue rather than a legal issue I can raise. If I take the question in the form of as a litigator that has to defend lawsuits, obviously a clear and convincing evidence standard is easier to work with someone, but you may end up in the same place where the court said that there are genuine issues of material facts which preclude summary judgment. Mr. Gaddy made a very good point. Under the case law we have in Alaska on summary judgment, if there's any issue of fact which is material, even if it comes down to inferences that jurors may draw from the same undisputed facts, it has to go to trial. Thank you.
Yeah.
Further, Representative Kurtula.
Thanks, Ms. Voigtlander. But isn't it true you might stand a much better chance of not having to go past a summary judgment motion if we raise the standard to clear and convincing?
Through the chair to Representative Kurtula, as opposed to the lower threshold, yes.
Thank you.
Further comments on amendment number 4 as amended? Is there still objection?
Yeah.
There's still an objection. The committee secretary, please call the roll.
Representative Green?
Pass.
Is that a yes?
Pass.
Representative James?
No.
Representative Murkowski?
Yes.
Representative Croft?
Yes.
Representative Kurtula?
Yes.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Chairman Codd?
No. So amendment number 4 passes. Brings us to amendment number 5. Representative Croft, can you tell me the order of your remaining amendments?
I'm going to have you guess, Mr. Chair. No, I can tell you that I'm not going to be offering A1.
I'll withdraw them off.
A1, I'll withdraw, and I guess the only other one that I would offer is A4. So my last amendment that is titled A4 would be then what number 5 now?
Okay. Amendment number 5 is titled A4.
And I think and hope that we can be much briefer on this one.
Amendment number 5.
Mr. Chairman.
Move it.
I move amendment number 5.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
For the purposes of discussion, I'll discuss. Amendment number 5 simply limits the immunity to property damage. In other words, if the inaction, negligence action causes personal injury, if a municipal hospital allows someone to die, if an Otis elevator under our control crashes to the ground, you would still have the ordinary negligence standard. In property damage cases, this immunity would apply, but not in personal injury cases.
Is
still going to maintain my objection. I just don't see the rationale why we're not just affording blanket immunity. How many times would a hospital have to go to the chip maker to determine whether or not it was reasonable in its approach to resolving the Y2K? It's not clear on that particular aspect of what would be reasonable. Further discussion on amendment number 5. If not, we'll turn to Gail. Gail, did you hear the amendment?
Yes, to the representative. I did hear the amendment. I guess the only legal issue I would raise is just because there are terms that are often confused. As Representative Cross pointed out, this would allow claims and no immunity for personal injuries. Personal injuries can be both bodily injury claims, such as if we were to use Representative Cross' illustration of an elevator crashing and presumably someone breaking bones, that would be in the nature of bodily injury. If you got your check delayed and as a result suffered emotional distress, that would be a personal injury, although not a bodily injury. Many of the states that have grappled with these Y2K issues have also grappled with the differences between personal injury and bodily injury as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Further comments on amendment number 5. Seeing or hearing none, I will maintain my objection. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Green?
No.
Representative James?
No.
Representative Murkowski?
No.
Representative Croft?
Yes.
Representative Kutula?
Yes.
Chairman Cott?
No. So amendment number 5 fails to be adopted. We have additional amendments. We do have one more amendment by Representative Petula, and you're going to withdraw.
Don't need to offer that. Yes, thank you.
Amendment. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
We now have a bill that's been amended numerous times. Representative Green.
And I would ask the indulgence of the committee to perhaps a conceptual amendment. That all of these things that we have done to remove the blanket immunity, would there be any merit to a conceptual amendment to this effect, that this stuff that we have done in no way diminishes a state or municipality's immunity under any other legal doctrine or provision of law, so that they can't utilize this kind of statement and extract it to some other kind of litigation?
Representative Croft.
I wouldn't have any objection to that. I'm not sure it's necessary, but in these kind of things, it might be.
Seeing no objection,
safe.
Hearing no objection, then it's adopted.
I will have a bill drafter work it.
Yeah, we'll get the bill drafter done.
Because there may be two or three places
in there.
That
I'm glad you got Representative Croft to say, I got no objection. I mean, I wanted to catch him before he thought about it. Hey, we'll include that conceptual amendment. Are there further comments on House Bill 57? Seeing or hearing none, wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative James.
Yes, I move out House Bill 57 as amended with the fiscal note and individual recommendations.
It is a motion to move House Bill 57 from the committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note. Are there objections? Seeing or hearing none? It's gone. Thank goodness. Thank you, Gail, and thank you, Mike, for your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you, the chair and the members of the committee for their indulgence in my comments.
Since
Representative Roakberg has not returned, he will not be able to report the Senate bill back from the subcommittee back to the parent committee. So at this point, we'll take a 2-minute at ease and then commence with the three resolutions. And that will give us time to call on the sponsors or their staff.
Probably not.
Call the House Judiciary Committee back to order to hear three resolutions dealing with changing the constitutional requirements for initiatives / referendums. It is the intent of the chair to at least briefly have counsel to the committee cover the main differences between the three, and then to bring up the sponsors individually, starting with HJR 3, HJR 7, and 25, give their opening remarks. At that point, we will then turn to the teleconference lines and get all the folks that are on the teleconference in, and they can address one or all of the initiatives or all the resolutions at the same time. So, counsel, can you briefly cover the high points of all the three initiatives?
Yes, for the record, my name is Corey Winchell, and I'm judiciary staff. I'm an attorney down in Washington, so technically I'm not counsel within this jurisdiction. Just want to make that caveat. I don't want to get in trouble with the bar. What we did here is we're basically doing a cross analysis of all the HJRs in front of you. The first one, HJR 3, by Representative Bundy, pertains first of all only to natural resources.
Excuse me, and to invite the two other members to the table, if you'd like, Representative Bundy and Representative Logan.
Mr. Chairman, I can't see the board from there.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, pertains only to natural resources, requiring 10% of the votes cast in the previous election on the petition. So there's no changes in this. The major change that we have here is the two-third voter approval for passage. So once it's on the ballot, you have two-thirds. You have to acquire two-thirds of the voter of the previous, basically of the ballots cast for passage. So this is pertaining only to natural resources. Down here with Representative Williams, this pertains to all initiative issues. So any issue that goes before referendum or initiative requires 10% of the votes cast in the previous election, so there's no change there. 10% must come from 30 House districts. That's a 3/4. So we're up in that. Basically, what you're doing here is you're requiring all the districts to have a voice before it gets onto the ballot. And then there's no change, I don't think. There's no change. It's 51%, 50% plus one. Representative Ogun's pertains only to fish and wildlife, requiring 10% of the votes cast in the previous election, and it ups it to 100%. In other words, you're going to get 10% out of each of the 40 districts. Those are the substantive differences between them. Other than that, just when you're dealing with issues, it's Representative Williams that just does to all initiative issues, and the other ones are natural resource and fish and wildlife, respectively.
So if I understand it, then HR 3, offered by Representative Bundy, deals with the end product of when it gets on the ballot, and the other two deals primarily with how it gets there.
Correct. The way I read it, and Representative Bundy come up in a disagree, but basically what we're doing is we're looking for voter approval. That's the only issue. There's no change to the current statutes.
Representative Croft?
And I'd just like to ask Representative Ogun whether he wanted us to consider the old idea or the new idea. I mean, the HJR 25 as it stands, or the possibility of HJR 25 being put in the Constitution as a restriction, just a bar.
Yeah, well, at this point, we have the current resolution as introduced before us. And when he gets up here, then we'll hear from on that particular resolution. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're really talking somewhere around 500 or 600 votes, 500 or 600 signatures per district.
We're looking at 10%, and most of the districts, I believe, when I was looking at the votes cast, was anywhere from 7,000 to 12,000, most of them averaging...
Ooh, no.
Oh, in each of the 40 districts.
No. I think it's closer, maybe 5,000 to 6,000.
It's probably closer between 5,000 and 6,000.
Yeah.
Okay, well then 10% of that, correct.
So it's
10%.
500 or 600 per district, which is certainly not insurmountable. then, in addition to that, I guess...
You still have to get the 10%.
Yeah.
The 10% is still there. It's not changed. So last election, there were 227,156 ballots cast.
Uh-huh.
Not all ballots cast were for House members. That's the total card count according to the Division of Elections.
Uh-huh.
You need to have 10% of those signatures to get on the ballot. That's the initial one of the preliminary requirements is mm-hmm. to get those 10%.
And this just requires they be spread around.
In two of the cases, it requires that you have to get the numbers, but you have to spread it around the various districts.
HGR 3 doesn't make any changes to the current.
No, however, it does.
I have a question.
Once it's on the ballot.
Once it's on the ballot, it goes up to 2/3.
The others remain.
Yeah.
50 plus one.
Okay.
In that one, in HGR 7 now, where the 10% must come from 30 House districts, is one signature in each of those districts enough, or do they have to have a certain number of the votes in that district?
It's 10% coming from each of the 30 districts. So you need 10%. You need, Representative Green was saying, you need the 500 votes.
Out of each district.
Right. You can spread it around to the districts, but... yes, it's 30 districts. You have to get at least 10% of the election of the ballots cast.
And still meet the initial threshold of having 22,272. Okay, thank you very much. We'll then call upon Representative Bundy first.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Con Bundy, Representative District 18. Thanks to you and the committee for taking on your initiative afternoon. And I would like to say at the outset that I think council was correct in their staff was correct in their characterization that HGR 3 would essentially raise the bar at the end of the initiative process, and 7 and 25 are going to raise the bar at the beginning of the process. I think if that may be a little oversimplification, but certainly let the other representatives speak to their resolution, but that's how I view it. Mr. Chairman, as many of us realize, Alaska is a very resource-dependent state. In the past, oil paying for 85% of cost of government. At this point, we may wonder if that was a favor or not entirely. But in any case, it's my strong belief that resources should be managed by trained professionals in an ideal situation. We should try to keep politics as much as possible out of resource allocation or management. There, in my view of history in other states where the legislature has, for instance, set fish and game limits and seasons and that sort of thing, it gets very politicized, and we have hired some well-compensated experts who have studied resource management, and we really are foolish not to defer to their judgment. Unfortunately, as we go through the legislative process, we get to hear from their judgment. But unfortunately, through the initiative process, the general public is not often privy to the judgment of trained professionals in the field. I've chosen to limit my resolution to resources because I think they are so critical to the state. Other folks have different perceptions. In no way do I intend to preclude or limit the public process or the public having access to this. As a matter of fact, I think that this resolution elevates the public's ability to be involved in the initiative process. I, however, have said because they're so critical to the state of Alaska, such a resource-dependent state, that I have raised the bar in this area and in not other areas. Others might argue civil rights or something are equally as important, but that's not my role to discuss at this point. Certainly I have confidence in the voters and want to keep their access open. However, as many of us are aware, the influence of the media on our behavior is considerable. I would just call your attention to the not too distant past when we had a Super Bowl where commercials were sold for millions of dollars for a very short exposure on the air. Not because the people that purchase those commercials love football, but because they understand the incredible impact on public perception that the media has. Money has become an important factor of shaping the media impact on public perception. Certainly, the vast majority of Alaskans have access to TVs, radios, internet, and we are as susceptible to influence by the media as anyone else. One of the reasons that I've chosen to address this is I also am very aware of the urban-rural split, with half the population of Alaska in Anchorage, with conceivably half the voters in Anchorage. We could have an initiative pass virtually by support from one city. I'm not sure that that's what we want to do, and by raising the bar to two-thirds, it certainly requires what other initiatives have asked, and that is a broader participation statewide. As I said, I've come at it from rather raising the bar at the beginning of the process, but at the end of the process. I chose that in part because I have studied other states that have raised the requirements and made it, trying to make participation in the initiative process, I would say, more challenging. And the courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have said that that is not constitutional, that their vision of free speech when it comes to political issues is very broad. And I think, and I've had testimony in the past from Pam Cook, that certainly HDR3 meets the requirements of the Alaska Supreme Court. The unknown, of course, is what would the U.S. Supreme Court think of this, but I have better luck guessing when the ice is going out on the Yukon than I would of what the U.S. Supreme Court would do. So the point is that this broadens an opportunity or a requirement, if you will, for public involvement. I think HDR3 simply elevates the need to educate voters. Past initiatives and folks that I've talked with, and this is my characterization, but I think they've admitted to exaggeration, distortion, maybe deception, as they have encouraged voters to sign up for their various initiatives and then to vote for the various constitutional amendments or initiatives. I think by requiring a higher level of acceptance in the public, a higher level to pass, that we can't, we're less likely to have folks who will go to a momentary majority without stepping on anyone's toes. I would point out the last gubernatorial election as to how some folks could, under influence of a great deal of money, perhaps come to a momentary conclusion that they later regretted or changed their opinion on. I think that with HDR3 and the requirement of getting two-thirds votes, we'll get more factual information and fewer of these feel-good, quick distortion kinds of arguments. I think that that it works to the advantage of the public to be more well-informed. Some states have been very negatively affected by what I would call ballot box biology, and I would ask you to consider for a moment, if you would, if we really want 50.1% of the voters from now in the foreseeable future to make very definitive decisions about things like commercial fishing, perhaps fishing in general, hunting, specific means or methods of hunting, certainly oil issues, timber mining, et cetera, et cetera. Is that fair? Is that truly a reflection of the will of the people when 49.9% of the people might be opposed to what happens, but a very slim majority would be allowed to support an issue. Is this indeed an opportunity to disenfranchise a large portion of the voters? Now, most issues do not pass at that close a margin, but it's a possibility. And I want to strongly stress that I'm not trying to exclude the public from this participation, but I think by raising the bar, I encourage in public participation. Certainly, if I support an issue and I need to know I need two-thirds of the voters to support this issue, I'm going to work even harder and more diligent. And, of course, if I oppose the issue, I may work very hard because I realize I do have an opportunity of stopping it. So I think it cuts both ways. I would like to speak very briefly to those that are the opposition I've heard for this. The people who have spoken to me quite strenuously that they don't like me messing with the process, that they that this somehow exhibits a distrust of the public, I simply would like to say that this initiative would have to be approved by the present system. That is, it would have to be approved by 50% of the voters who voted in the past, that would vote in that election. So if those who oppose this have a high level of confidence in the current system, they have no reason to fear this resolution because the public will ultimately decide. And if they think that 50% is enough to decide an issue like this or any other initiative that comes forward, they should not be concerned. They should not be fearful. They should take comfort in supporting the system that they think currently works. Again, I'd just like to say that ultimately I think we should raise the bar for something as important as allocation of our or management of our natural resources. With that, I would open myself to questions from the committee.
Are there questions? And I would ask the committee to keep them to a minimum, because we do have two others and a litany of folks online. Representative Green, then.
This is a very simple one. Con, do you know about how many or what percentage of the of these types of things pass with two-thirds vote as opposed to just simple majorities?
I don't know of any initiative concerning natural resources that has ever passed with two-thirds vote. That may well have been, however, because they realized they only needed 50%, and anything beyond that is just gravy, so you don't work that hard.
Representative Murkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bundy, I'm looking at the list of the initiatives that have appeared on the Alaska ballot over the years and trying to see which one of these might fall into the category regarding natural resources. And I don't mean to be flip, but, you know, as elected officials, we all like to say how our greatest natural resources is our children. Mm-hmm. And is there going to be a potential argument out there in terms of, well, is this an initiative that relates to natural resources, or are you just stretching it because only one small aspect of the initiative relates to it? Looking through the list, there appear to be probably half a dozen or so that would fall under that category of natural resources, but is there a definition of what might apply?
I believe constitutionally, when they discuss natural resources or resources that are found in their natural state. But of course, again, that may be something the courts would decide. Certainly for the record, my definition is the more classic natural resources, excluding something as important as our children, but those that are found in a natural state, land, water, and animals and fish.
Representative Croft.
Which of the initiatives do you consider to be natural resource? Do you have the list of initiatives that...
I do not, no. Certainly, there was one on the past ballot. There have been, well, I shouldn't say. I don't, but my able staff.
They gave it to us.
There we go.
Yeah.
And some would say from Willow that moving to state capital would be an act, but I'll leave that one alone. I think the referendum on disposing of state lands certainly would fall in that area. Personal consumption, fish and game, though I've been told that this does not affect the subsistence proposal.
Claiming state ownership of federal land, do you think, or not? I really am trying to figure out which
that,
ones you can.
That sounds to me a little ambiguous. Let me go to some that I think are perhaps more direct to the point. Certainly same day airborne hunting of certain animals. The snaring initiative that was most recent on. The repeal of limited entry, we're talking about the fishing industry, I think that would certainly fall in a natural resource. But at a cursory view, it has been my impression that these were, they were, in spite of the importance of natural resources to Alaska, there have been a minimum number of initiatives that would address management or allocation.
Just very quickly on those are the ones that I picked out. I guess there's some gray area, but taking those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as the ones that are clearly natural resource ones, repeal of limited entry failed, the disposal of state lands passed by 56%, the personal consumption of fish and game failed, so it wouldn't be affected by yours. Aerial wolf hunting passed, but not by two-thirds, something less, and prohibiting trapping failed. So the only ones that, if this had been enacted since statehood, it would have really affected disposal of state lands and aerial wolf hunting, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. And I would say that, but I wouldn't say that it would, again, guarantee the failure of or passage of either one of those, because the ground rules would have been different.
Representative Petula.
Oh, thank you, through the chair. I just wondered if you had any opinion on whether or not this should more properly be part of a constitutional convention.
And I did thank you, Mr. Chairman, or through the chair, to represent Kurtula. And I would encourage you to chat with Tam Cook. She had a four-pronged test from the Alaska State Supreme Court, and this initiative met, in her opinion, their criteria for an initiative.
Thank you. Further questions for Representative Bundy? Thank you, Con.
And thank you.
Next call up, Representative Williams. Moving us over to HJR 7, which is takes a little different approach. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for scheduling this today. And staff went through the numbers fairly well, and it looks all right to me. So. But basically, I introduced the HJR 7 to ensure that we get statewide support when we put initiatives before the voters. Currently, because of our population dispersal, the initiative sponsors can easily go down and get the 21 or 25,000 signatures from one region or one community or two. And I'm concerned that the whole of Alaska will suffer as the question after questions of limited perspective is placed on the ballot. I think that this legislation was set up, like I said earlier, to get to make sure that people from Saxman are able to have their input, or from Barrow. In your packet, you'll see where we had, how many initiatives we had in 1998. We had five, and most of that came from one area. In the Wolf Initiative, there was only 48 signatures from Ketchikan, 28 for term limits. In the marijuana issue, there was 34. English only was 24. Bill Borges, 31. That doesn't give us a full insight on it. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm asking for your support on this bill. It doesn't, like Representative Bundy said earlier, his is, gets us at the back gate. Mine is at the front gate on any initiative that comes before the state.
Thank you, Representative Williams. Certainly, by requiring the 10% to come from the various districts in the previous election would give greater representation. And it does cover all the issues. It's a little more broad-based. It's not narrow in scope. There are certainly initiatives out there that we want to see pass and ones we don't want to see pass. I mean, depending on your particular point of view, and that does raise a threshold. What reaction would you think the public would have if someone were sponsoring an initiative dealing with legislative term limits? This made it tougher. I mean, not that I'm in support of term limits, because I'm not, but it made it tougher. What reaction? I mean, because the general public.
I wouldn't know how to answer that, Mr. Chairman, but when this was put into the Constitution, it was done when there wasn't any telecommunications that we have today, faxes, telephones, and transportation. We couldn't get from one part of the state to the other. Before statehood, most of the population was here in Southeast, and there was hardly any population in the interior and in Anchorage. And they were concerned about how we can get these initiatives, and that's why they set up the 10% of the ballots cast and one signature in 28 precincts. As far as making it more difficult, I wouldn't say right now it would make it more difficult. I think what I'm trying to do is get a broad statewide perspective on this and getting everybody's input. When you get people out talking about the initiative, everyone is more informed. As today, as you can see, most of it came from just one region, and people in Ketchikan didn't hardly know what it was all about, or at least in Saxman.
Certainly, it would be more difficult in the sense that you won't have some person from New York standing outside the Anchorage airport collecting enough signatures to get it on the ballot. At least they'll have to go to the various districts to collect the signatures. Yours primarily deals with the entry level. Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I just might, I meant to add in my opening statement that I don't see any competition between the three approaches. I don't think this is an either or, and I don't see them in competition where one would preclude the other. And so I appreciate you hearing all three, though, and I see no problem with all three going through the process and the public having a choice of any or all of the three.
Representative Williams, I'm going to ask you a question, and you may not know the answer. It may be better for Representative Hogan. He's a scholar on the Constitution. Or it may be better for division of elections, but the 10% required from the individual districts based on the previous votes cast in that particular district from the previous election, would that number come from the total votes cast or the votes cast for the House member?
The House member district, I believe. It would, you'd have to have a total of 10% of the votes cast throughout the state. And you'd have to have 10% from each district. Like in Ketchikan, we had 6,300 votes cast. You would need 636 votes, signatures.
Were those votes cast for the House member, the competing House members, or just total votes cast?
Total votes cast.
Because there is a difference between the number of votes cast in the state and the number of votes cast for House members. No. It's like, well, 227,000 was the number of votes cards cast for 1998, and the total House votes were 199,000. But since we're dealing with House seats.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you could probably get that from the department.
Representative Murkowski.
Thank you. Representative Williams, do you know how long you have to gather signatures for the petition, for an initiative petition in Alaska?
Probably a year or 2 years. I know that the, I think the term limits it took 2 years, and to get it on the statewide ballot, I think you have to have it every 2 years, I'm sure.
Just to...
Again, this probably the department can answer that.
I would like to know that information because I think I like your idea of getting support for a particular initiative from all areas of the state. What would concern me is if there is a tight window to collect those signatures, it may be very, very difficult to do it if you've got to, if you're down in Ketchikan, and most of these, or many of the initiative organizations, or if you will, are grassroots, and how do you organize them to get them going in Ketchikan simultaneously with Bethel and all over? So I would like to know what that window is, because I think it might make a difference.
I wouldn't know what it would in the master department that, but if you look in the amount of signatures that were gathered by districts, and the Wolf, every district had someone had a signature signed. I don't think that the time limit would really hurt. If you'd get a better perspective, you'd have to talk to more people. We have 15,000 people in Ketchikan, you know, and only 48 people that signed up for the Wolf, you know, you begin to wonder, did we vote correctly?
Representative Croft?
I have the information that you gave me and that someone on my staff gave me, I don't know where it appeared from, but on the 1998 initiatives, and none of those initiatives would have